You're listening to episode 110, Turning Post-Traumatic Stress into Post-Traumatic Strength with Dr. John A. King. Welcome to the Grass Gets Greener podcast, the show for survivors by survivors. I'm your host, Melissa Wilson, a bullying survivor and anti-bullying advocate. And each week you'll hear from a survivor who has overcome a traumatic experience to go on to not only survive, but thrive so that you can too, starting now. Hey guys, thanks so much for being here for this episode. You know I appreciate it, as always. And I have a really great episode for you today with Dr. John King of the Give Them a Voice Foundation. But before we get into it and I give you the highlights of what we'll be talking about, I do want to let you know about something. So if you listened to the last episode, I mentioned at the end of that one that I was creating a resource for you that lists the most common tools and strategies that my guests have used in their healing journeys. Some may be ones that you already use and some may be ones that you haven't tried yet. But I wanted to create something for you to have that you can go to whenever you need something to help you in your healing. This way you don't have to sift through all of the episodes to see what's worked for my guests. They're all right there in this document. Consider it a toolbox that's been pre-populated with the most common tools that have helped them. So if you're interested in grabbing that, it's totally free, and you can find it on the show notes page for this episode. That's going to be at thegrassgetsgreener.com/John King. And you'll see the box for it there at the end of the post. So I hope that you'll check that out and that you'll find it helpful. Now, to get on to today's episode, and we actually talk about the importance of having tools to help you in your healing journey. A total coincidence, but very fitting. So John is going to share with us about his experience growing up sexually abused by multiple people. John is an advocate in the areas of sexual abuse and human trafficking, so we'll be talking about those topics. We don't get into a lot of detail about John's experiences, but if you've been sexually abused, then you could find what we talk about triggering, so I just want to make you aware of that. But here are some of the particular things we'll be talking about. John's going to share how he became more vulnerable for abuse after the abuse. And now John had actually repressed his memories from the abuse, and so he's going to share what it was like when those memories came back to him and how that affected his life. And he's going to talk about the difficulties he had in getting help because he was a male and how it was taboo for him to talk about it at the time. And we're going to talk about how we are ultimately the only person that can make us whole again. And John will share what some of his favorite tools have been in his healing journey and how he had to redefine what was normal for him. And we'll talk about the importance of giving yourself permission to do what you need to do to heal. So lots of good content in here, and regardless of what your background is, whether you were sexually abused or not, I think you'll find this episode helpful in guiding you in your journey. So without further ado, we're going to go ahead and get into it, and I'm going to go bring John on. John, welcome to the podcast, and thank you for joining me here today to share your story with us.
Well, that's my pleasure, Melissa. I really like what you do, what Grass Gets Greener stands for, and I love your little byline, let go of the past and live for today. I think that's very, very encouraging for people and very essential for people who have been through the sorts of things that we've been through.
Well, thank you. Yeah, and you know, I love what you're doing as well. And so I came across you on Instagram, actually, and after looking into your story and your organization, Give Them a Voice, I definitely wanted to have you on the show to not only share your story, but to talk about all the advocacy work that you're doing today in regard to sexual abuse and human trafficking. And I know we're going to talk about your own experience with these types of abuse, but what I love is how you've turned your post-traumatic stress into post-traumatic strength, as you say, and how you're helping others to do the same. And I love your resiliency. You say on your website that you refuse to quit and that you weren't going to die broken because of what someone else did to you. So I'm looking forward to hearing about how you've fought to take back your life and what that journey has been like. But first, I'd like us to start with what it was you went through so that we have the backstory. So, John, tell us, you know, what you'd like us to know about what you experienced, and then we'll go from there.
Sure. I was sexually abused by both my parents and their friends. Some of what happened to me probably would be deemed trafficking. Well, by definition, it is. So that's really what it was. It wasn't a particular family member. It was my mother and my father. And the genders were mixed. And that started a cycle of, I think, vulnerability for abuse. I think brokenness attracts brokenness. And we can get into a cycle, particularly growing up, of being in ongoing broken or abusive relationships. It doesn't stop when we're young. It can transfer over into business, you know, church life, relational life later on. And I found myself going from that family environment of abuse into the Scouts within Australia, and I was, again, sexually abused by leaders there. Then actually later on in college, when, you know, I was old enough to take care of myself and break away from some of the parental situations, I found myself in some circumstances, you know, waking up and being sexually abused by professors. And, you know, it always struck me as odd. These weren't things I ever went looking for, but these are things that came looking for me. And in part of my journey, I've had to come to terms with, people won't like this because they think that I'm affixing blame, or they'll feel I'm affixing blame to them, but there is something in us, our brokenness, that attracts that brokenness. And unless we go about repairing the walls of our soul, then we are always going to be vulnerable in those areas. And I think that's where the cycle perpetuates, where you hear about, you know, abusers abuse, alcoholics become, children of alcoholics become alcoholics. I think that's where those cycles actually go on, when you don't take the time to address those broken areas in your souls and really turn your scars into medals. Is something I like to tell people, is if you can take what is a scar and embarrassment, a thing, and turn it into a medal of victory, you've overcome it, then all of a sudden, by bringing something out into the light, by having conversations about it, by being open and vulnerable and transparent, you know, vulnerability really is courage, I believe. It's a real courageous thing. And I think by doing that, we can probably cut our recovery time probably close to half to three quarters.
Mm. Yeah, so true. I mean, like they say, you know, hurt people.
Yeah.
And it's just that cycle. And until we can kind of, you know, break that and find ways to heal ourselves, unfortunately, you know, yeah, we're going to hurt other people, or we're going to attract people who are going to continue to hurt us. So how old were you when the abuse started?
I was between 4 and 16, was when a big slab of these things happened. The stuff at college happened when I was in my early 20s, but this childhood stuff was between 4 and 16.
Mm-hmm. And I believe I read that you had repressed the memories as well.
Yeah. It's not uncommon. I think when you grow up in that sort of environment, there's a sense that it's normal for you. You've got nothing to compare it with, so it is just the only experience you have. So you don't really examine those things. Now, as a young man, the fact that I was having sex was actually applauded by my peers. You know, I lived in it. I'm 53, 54 this year. So growing up in those school environments and even college environments, it was very much, you know, applauded. Here I was, you know, 9, 10, 11. I've been having sex for half a dozen years. And it was, you know, something that, you know, wasn't, not encouraged, but it certainly by my peers, by other young men, wasn't something that was disparaged. It was celebrated. And so you don't grow up with a sense of what you're experiencing is wrong or even alien. It might seem a little odd, a little frustrated, but then again, you know, there's a biological occurrence that happens with ejaculation, and there's affirmation that comes from pleasing other people. So when your only form of touch is sexual, then you're constantly going back to those arenas to get that affirmation. Often, particularly in men that I've dealt with and helped, I find that between 35 and 45 is when a lot of things, if they're repressed or they haven't dealt with, really bubble to the fore, and they have to. There's often a cataclysmic event in a psychological or a psycho-emotional way that bring these things to the fore. And that was my case. I had these series of little pockets that I think about and think, well, that's unpleasant. Well, I don't know really what that means. It wasn't until I was 45, it was 3 o'clock on a Thursday afternoon, I think my journal says, and all these little buckets or frames came together and made like a movie, an 8mm movie, and I had total recall.
Wow.
And
Was there something that triggered it, right, in that moment, since you have like such a specific day and time that it happened?
No, I just remember it because it was a beautiful day. I remember thinking very clearly and sitting down in my shed, journaling about how wonderful the day was. And I felt, well, at that stage, I'd started to have some mood swings. I'd started to see what now I recognize as early either borderline personality disorder manifestations or post-traumatic stress manifestations. So I had some mood swings. There was a few things that were becoming increasingly difficult for me, but I had no reason, no hook that I could hang on and say, okay, this is why. And literally, I remember it just came back. And my wife at the time found me, curled up in a ball in the backyard sobbing. And I'd had full recall. And it didn't stop. The visions, the daymares, the nightmares didn't stop for probably 3 years continuously.
Wow. Wow, that must have been really difficult. I mean,
it was horrible, really.
Yeah,
it was
tough. Imagine.
It was very difficult because even I'd be in business meeting or in church functions or leadership meetings, and there'd be this continual panorama or this cinematic display of pornography that I'd seen, movies I'd been made to watch, acts that I was involved in, and they would just continually play. And it was very hard, as with trauma-based disorders, the perspective of reality becomes distorted because of the way the brain is trying to cope or just is given in and not coping in my case. And it's very hard to tell. You've got fight and flight kicking in. You've got all your paranoia stuff kicking in. Who do you trust? Who don't you trust? You've got all that stuff kicking in. So when it comes down to the reality becomes very distorted, add on top of that this ongoing onslaught of visions and recall, and it became very disconcerting. I didn't sleep a lot at the time. I trained myself to try and stay out of REM sleep, so I was sleeping 60 or 90 minutes at a time, and I'll do that a couple of times a night, and some nights I'd only sleep for 90 minutes. So I was constantly exhausted because every time I fell asleep, the nightmares started, and if I didn't catch it before REM, I'd get trapped in them for 2 or 3 days.
Oh.
It was impossible to get out. Very debilitating.
Yeah. So it sounds like before, all these pieces kind of came back, sounds like you were doing okay, but you were struggling a little bit maybe because you were having, flashes of things that you'd gone through. But then when they all kind of came together at that one time, then it sounds like that's when you really started to struggle with kind of, the after effects of what you had been through. Would that be a fair assessment?
I think so. I was very successful in business, very successful. I was involved in church work here in America and all over the world, and I ran a corporate training and consultancy company as well, wrote a bunch of books, ran a publishing company. And the strains or the emotional things were really interpersonal, the straining relationships in my first marriage. It was a challenge with my children because I was getting paranoid about them going. And they were growing up, they're hitting 12, 13, 14, my oldest daughter at the time. And, that's when I started getting fearful because here's this beautiful girl growing up. And I started to get just concerned, and I didn't understand why.
Mm. So this was before or after you remembered everything?
Just before. It was aberrant behavior. It just didn't make any sense, but these feelings – were real, they were hard to deny, yet even those emotions I ended up having to push down because it didn't make any sense to what I was experiencing. Why am I feeling like this? Why have I gone from being fairly confident, comfortable, trusting to totally paranoid about everything?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you didn't know where they were coming from.
Not at all. And then it really was just like the brain just flushed, you know, this festering thing just burst. And it was really like that. It just, boom, it just decided to cleanse itself.
Wow. Also, like, what sorts of, you know, struggles did you have? You said for like 3 years, you know, after you started to remember everything, that you just, you know, continued to go through that experience. What were sort of just those, you know, negative effects that came from that?
There was a couple. I went from being a very prolific speaker to having a chronic stutter. I couldn't be in crowds, which is very difficult when you're in sales, and especially when you make a living standing up and talking to, you know, tens of thousands of people at a time. I now had a chronic stutter. I was scared of crowds. I was very fearful. Very difficult making any new relationships or going to new venues or places. So that was very difficult. Inability to be able to think clearly. Memory problems because of the frontal lobe was shut down. So that was very difficult. I think one of the biggest challenges I had was when I realized after probably the first year that I needed to get some sort of therapy and help, was because I was male, there wasn't therapy or help available.
Mm.
I rang up you know, bunches of you know, therapy centers, counseling centers around the area that dealt with rape counseling, abuse counseling, support groups, and was repeatedly told that this sort of thing doesn't happen to men. I had one very conflicting situation with a receptionist of an organization when she accused me of just being a pervert that just wanted to come and prey on her poor women because women only go through this stuff. And it pissed me off beyond all means.
I can imagine.
Because it was just total bullshit. You know, here I was, I had no desire. I didn't want to even see or talk to someone. It's just my life was a total wreck, and I realized I'd taken it as far as I could. I ended up having to travel, I think it was 22 hours away, across states to South Dakota to find a therapist that I could talk to.
Wow, that's crazy.
So, you know, and she was very good, she was exceptional for the period of time that I connected with her. And very essential in part of the journey, but that was very frustrating because I was getting sicker. As a man, a lot of your identity is tied up in what you do and your ability to solve problems. So here I was, I'd lost my ability to provide for my family, all my key relationships maritally, and as far as my children were breaking down. I decided that I couldn't fix it, so I was prepared to get help, and I just couldn't find it. Mm. And it was a pretty dark period just there.
Mm. It sounds like you didn't really have anyone, you know, close to you that you could turn to talk about this stuff either.
No, I didn't. But the church that I was leading was full of very young people, you know, in their 20s and 30s, and so they didn't have the experience or the capacity to be able to deal with it. There's not a lot of, yeah. And remember also, this is 10 years ago, the conversation about the sexual abuse of boys and even the trafficking of boys is really in the last 12 months or so become, you know, part of the tapestry of what we're discussing. There's been a few things like the Sandusky stuff, the stuff that's been happening in England that, you know, it's like the world's woken up and realizing this, another 50% of the population that's affected by this. So even back then, having that conversation, it was a career killer because, you know, you ended up having to discuss how are you coping with this, and, you know, so business goes down the chute, opportunities fold. I couldn't get on an aeroplane. I just had to cancel events. So really my circle became very tight, and my wife at the time didn't couldn't understand how anyone could abuse someone like that. And really, it just put such a strain on our marriage that it just broke it. Because, you know, PDS is like that. It's a very emotional, volatile thing. And I remember writing one piece of poetry which simply said, "I scream to be seen." And I think that's what it is with PTS. Sometimes it's very volatile, but it's never at anyone else in the room. It's really at the universe, because your soul just feels like broken glass and you just want it to stop.
Yeah. So it sounds like going to get therapy was kind of the first step in, you know, beginning to heal from all of this.
The therapy?
Yeah.
I actually think the first step was I woke up one morning with the most incredible, frightening feeling that I'd ever had. And it was, I found out later, it was a sense of peace. I couldn't ever remember feeling at peace. And I had this peace, and I remember very clearly this sense of God saying to me, that is a peace beyond understanding, and that he was not my fairy godmother but my heavenly father, and that this would always be with me and I needed to learn to manage it. I think up to that point I'd been wanting some sort of miracle, be it a therapist or be it a book, albeit another survivor, to give me that key, that something that would help start me down a journey, that a miracle moment, as it were. And I think when I realized that I would always have to deal with this, is actually the day I started to get better. And therapy and finding a therapist was no longer my focus, but I realized would be a tool in my toolbox and part of my process. I think we get very enamored on therapy as the answer. I noticed on your website you talk about coaching people. I do something very similar. I took all my corporate coaching experience and turn it into recovery coaching, similar to what you've done with the bullying. And I think as coaches we know that the best we can ever do is walk alongside someone.
Right.
And at some point, if we've done our job well, they will graduate beyond us and they will be able to walk in a wholeness which is theirs uniquely, and they'll go down the track. And I think when I realized that the only person that was going to get me to whole was me, and that I needed to acquire as many tools, be they books, relationships, encounters, whatever, that they were only ever going to be part of my toolbox, that ultimately the responsibility for wholeness was mine. And I really think that's the point when it started to turn for me. I think people can get fixated that if they get the right therapist with the right advice, they're a little bit like it's an a la carte meal instead of a smorgasbord. You know what I mean? So you'd never walk in there and yell, "Oh, there's bloody Brussels sprouts," you know, and throw a tantrum, you just miss them. You know, just move on to the creamy donuts or whatever you want, you know. I think when we're looking for a therapist to bring an a la carte answer to our issue, puts too much pressure on the therapist and too much pressure on the patient. Whereas if you see the therapist as one aspect of all the options you've got, then you actually use them as a tool. You'll develop, come to a point, plug in for a therapist, unplug, develop like a coach, you know.
Yeah, no, I love how you look at it that way, and you have, you know, a toolbox of these different, you know, tools and resources and strategies that you've collected that have helped you along the way. Because, yeah, ultimately, you know, it does come down to us doing the work and figuring out, you know, what we need to help ourselves. And yes, there are, you know, people and resources available to us out there that can help us, but it's still, you know, it comes down to us and just being able to work on the areas that, you know, are broken and need our attention. So I think that, you know, that's a great approach. And also, you know, it allows us to have control over our healing, right? And we get to determine kind of what that's going to look like and what we want to work on and where we want to take our lives going forward, you know, because ultimately we get to control that. You know, we didn't get to control what happened to us, you know, but we can control where we're going to go in the future, yeah. You know. So what are some of like your favorite tools, you know, that have helped you along the way?
I go to the gym. I'm an old boxer and I am an old bodybuilder, amateur bodybuilder. The gym is very important to me. It centers me. It's a starting point for a positive experience in the day, gets the adrenals going. I'm very aware of the interaction of myself, my body, and my environment. Diet's played a very big part. Getting off sugar, you know, I love making cookies for my kids and me, you know. So I'm not talking freakish levels, but I am aware that there's a direct tie in between sugar consumption, anxiety, and depression. So, and, you know, people often they talk about comfort eating. Well, that's always the worst thing because you're starting to trigger this chemical reaction in your body. Now, if you overlay that with, you know, a propensity towards either BDP or your PTS or whatever it is that you're dealing with in terms of a mental condition, if you're introducing a substance into your body in an already heightened state that is a known cause or provocateur towards things like anxiety and depression, then you're setting yourself up for fail. So I'm aware of what those outside stimuluses are and their impact. I take that as far as if I'm feeling down, I make sure I wear bright colored clothing. I make sure the music I'm listening to is positive or energetic, not negative. I love blues. I love classical music. But if I am in a rough spot, I'll always crank it up. And I know they sound a little bit simplistic to people, but if you look at your body, your mind, your heart, your soul as an entire system, then you need to understand that whatever you're going to do in one area is going to affect the other, and you have to manage the system. It's not just managing your thought life or your health life or your food intake or your relationships. You've got to manage the whole system. And if you're not managing that whole system, then you will get out of balance very easily, which is a challenge, but it does mean that you can get back into balance very quickly just by making these adjustments. It sounds laborious, and it is. It's very tedious, especially early on when things were very tough. I had, you know, lists of things that I could and couldn't do, or I had challenges with or not have challenges with. And I wasn't necessarily good at them, but what I was aware that they would impact me. And then, you know, you've always got the sneaky buggers that just come up and you get massively triggered and you end up, you know, with your world falling down around your pant knees, you know, it's like, but there's nothing you can do about that.
Mm. Yeah, I think, you know, awareness is so important, like you were saying there, just to know kind of what you need and what helps or what makes things worse and, you know, making the right decisions based on that.
Yeah, I think one of the things that really helped me was giving myself permission, redefining normal, you know, what is normal. I had to redefine normal for myself. You know, normal people get up at 6, normal people go to the gym at 7, normal people have breakfast and drive to work, normal people. So that's what normal, and I tried to do normal and it just wasn't going to work for me. Because for me, if I slept past 3 in the morning, then I'd have nightmares. So I used to go to the gym. So I'd be eating lunch around breakfast time. But then for me, normal was having a sleep in the afternoon around 2:30 or 3 so I could still function as a father and as a husband. So I redefined what was normal for my life and normal for me. And I gave myself permission because I figured one day that if I had cancer, or if I was an amputee or I was in a wheelchair, those around me would make allowances for myself, but I would also make allowances for myself. I wouldn't limit myself, but it wasn't so much a disability I came to see it as a changeability. I needed to be able to change according to my ability because I had changed. My brain had changed. I was no longer the man I was. I could remember my 30-year-old self, but I would never be him again. So I needed to come to terms and come centered with who I was. So going forward, I would be able to build on that foundation and construct a life. And I think that is a very important come to moment for me. And I think for anyone, that it's giving yourself permission to do what you need to do. Not recluse yourself or be a victim, because I abhor the victim narrative. It's something I find myself very difficult to even admit to being a victim of anything, or even a survivor of anything. It's like, I want to be seen beyond surviving. I'm thriving. I'm a thriver of sexual abuse and human trafficking, which is really odd thing. You can't make a bumper sticker out of it because it messes with people. But really, that's what it is. I want my life to thrive. I want it to be part of my story, because it is who I am. I'm not ashamed or embarrassed by it. It is who I am, comfortable with who I am as a man. And I would not be this without that. Now, I do sometimes wonder who I could have been and what life could have been if this didn't happen to me, particularly for my first marriage and my relationship with my children. That is an area of concern or regret or guilt at times. But this track and this path that I'm on is one I have to embrace. And I think you can only come to terms with that when you realize that if you have to get up at 3, you get up at 3. If you need to sleep at 2, you need to sleep at 2. If you've got to find a job that works around that, so be it. You don't do it out of a sense of a victim. Oh, poor me. I have to. It's like, no, this is me. This is who I am. My life is stinking awesome. And this is how I run my life. Mm-hmm. And I think that that attitude is the very thing that'll force you down the road.
Mm-hmm. And that's just it, right? It's an attitude. That's what it comes down to.
Mm-hmm. It does. Stay off Pinterest and start to live.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it can be difficult to, accept that things are going to be different, but it's about how you look at them. Are you looking at them as being different in a bad way, or different maybe, in a good way? Finding something about it that you can feel good about, and just embracing it as your new way of doing things. And, you're doing it that way because that's what's good for you. That's what's going to help you to feel better. And that's really all that matters. It's not about, being, poor me. I have to do things this way now. And this isn't how I, expected to be doing them. But it's just about, just kind of embracing, the way you need things to be for yourself now and being okay with that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't want it to sound easy to people. That's not what I'm trying to convey.
Right.
When I talk about this, it's very much a, it's an everyday thing and an everyday struggle. I know today I just posted something, a meme that went out, and it's called Take a Shower and Move On. It's on the Dr. John King site. It says simply this: shit doesn't always turn into fertilizer. Sometimes it's just shit. You can stand there and try and sprout a flower, or climb out of the hole and go have a shower and move on. And I wrote that because yesterday was an extremely tough day.
Mm.
So it's not like it's never a tough day. Most of my days are full of difficulties. It's just that I just have to decide to have a shower and move on every day. And I think that's what wears people down. I think people get comfortable with the narrative of being a victim. And I think they get comfortable with even the peace and comfort that having been through the sorts of things we've been through, there does come a peace and comfort of identification with that. Okay, I've allowed everyone else to define me at this. I've defined me at this. I'm comfortable in this. And there's a certain sort of attention that comes with that, of comfort and expectations. People expect some things, don't expect some things. And I think it can actually be a little bit like a warm brownie. I think the only way you can grow beyond it and thrive is to realize that this is part of your journey, not the end of your journey. So you have to get unsettled with that comfortable feeling. I would love to be able to relax in a sense, not be so fanatical about my gym or my music or my sugar or my clothing or even the relationships I keep or the movies I watch or don't watch. But if when I do that, I feel like I'm allowing my past to define me and not refine me. And I don't want whatever happened to me to ever be the my stopping point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, tell us about what you call, you know, post-traumatic strength. I mentioned that in the beginning, you know, how you've turned post-traumatic stress into post-traumatic strength. What do you mean by that?
I was in a business meeting about, it was probably 3 years after John Ageddon. So it was about 2011. And I was in this business meeting and I was sitting there with some partners I had at the time and we were negotiating a contract. And we got all the way through it. It was very, very positive. And then in the very last moment, one of the people with the company we were negotiating with did something. They crossed their legs in a different manner. They turned their head in a different manner and their voice changed just ever so slightly. And when we left the meeting, my two colleagues were celebrating the contract that we were bound to get. And I told them straight out, I said, we won't get it. We're just not going to get it. And, you know, they just raged at me about being a Debbie Downer. And they said, why? And I said, because her voice trembled, her legs crossed, and she tilted her head slightly. And they thought that was just ridiculous. Now, you know, I've never had any training in those sorts of areas. But later I got to think about it, that all those intuitive signals were things I taught myself to be aware of because they're a matter of survival growing up. I had to be able to read a room. When I was in a room of people that were going to use me or take advantage of me, I had to find the person who would be less evil to me or less hurtful to me. And I needed to be able to read a room in my home, and I needed to be able to read moods and be predictive of moods and what was required or not required. It was a matter of pure survival. So here I was, and this was a stressor because I was always constantly on edge around people, always, you know, interpreting, misinterpreting, whatever. And I always was very dismissive of it. But when this thing happened, a week later or 2 weeks later, we got a call saying no. In fact, the client that we were with has taken our entire proposal, doing it themselves with another body. And the people I was with said, dude, you're absolutely right. You've got some sort of superpower. And I thought, okay, that's what I've got now. I've got a superpower. This is my superpower. I don't have an illness. I have a superpower that's been honed by survival. My strength is actually a strength. And it was a skill or an intuition or ability I started to listen to in myself, listen to in my interactions with other people. And I found that there's this inner voice, this intuition, this thing started to become a major strength for me. And I started to do some research on the whole post-traumatic strength things or stress to strength stuff. And there were some papers written in the UK in the last 18 months, I believe it is, that looked at this phenomenon, that people with post-traumatic stress often have developed other aspects of their life to be very strengthful or you know, strong. And I even look at what's happened to me is my journey started by writing poetry. I published a bunch of poetry online as the author on a site called No Working Title. And I published a book, hardcover book, dealing with my journey all in poetry and art form. Now, I was a writer up to that stage. I was never a poet. But here I was, that my favorite, and still to this day, my favorite form of expression is writing poetry. And when I looked at how, and I had some brain scans done that showed how my brain, what areas of my brain wasn't working and what areas were working or had rewired or overworking. With the shutting down of the frontal lobe, the left side of my brain, right side of my brain was overcompensating, and that being the creative aspect or the creative hemisphere, the left side being the more, you know, line upon line, predictive, calculating side. That were areas that I was struggling with that I never struggled with before. But on the other side, these creative things started to just manifest very easily for me. And I realized that I could either bemoan losing some analytical power, or I could celebrate having gained some creative aspects. And again, it was another thing. Okay, well, my stress in one area has turned into a strength in the other area. And I started to build a range of different things around what was now a strength instead of, as I said, bemoaning the loss or an area that was a stress.
Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah. So it sounds like what's also called post-traumatic growth.
Yes.
Right. Yep. Yeah. 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 And again, I think it just comes back to what we're focusing on, right? I mean, we can focus on the negative, or we can, you know, try to find some positives and focus on that.
Yeah, I agree. You know, your focus becomes your reality.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And, you know, exactly what you said, what you give you to is what you get.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how are you doing today overall, John?
I'm good. You know, like, it's Tuesday. It's awesome. first Tuesday I've had in this week and the last one I'll have. So I'm making the most of it. This morning at around 9 was difficult, but you know, I've stopped assessing my victories in terms of days. I think that was another thing that was very helpful. My wife, now I had the pleasure and the privilege of getting married again just last November. And I think I've got to remember a 6-month thing or something coming. I'm sure she'll remind me. But I would often see any bad moment in a day would cause me to wipe off the entire day, any bad day, a wipe off a week, and any bad week, wipe off a month. But what my Melissa has been able to do for me is say, you know, baby, we just had a difficult 15 minutes, or you just had a tough hour. And that gives me the ability and freedom to, you know, have a struggle, but then put it up, put a ribbon on it, and move on. So how is Tuesday? It's awesome. Talking to you, I'm really hoping this is going to help some people. 9 o'clock was difficult, but the rest of the day is going to be fantastic. Now, tomorrow is probably going to be awesome, but if I have a difficulty, it'll be one part of a day. It doesn't matter if it's 12 hours of that one day. It's just 12 hours. The rest of the day is going to be great, probably because I'm asleep, but it'll be great, you know.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I think, again, it's an outlook thing.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, I love that. And I mean, that's something I've had to learn to do myself is, you know, just, hey, if I'm having a bad morning, you know, it doesn't mean the rest of the day is going to be bad, or, you know, whatever the case may be. Because I think a lot of times, you know, when that sort of thing happens, we give it too much power and we let it take up more space than it needs to.
Yeah, you know, I'm writing another book at the moment on, it's called Going Again. Talking about, because I got this documentary, I'm involved in this documentary, which really was the start of this last whole part of healing for me. They found my poetry online and in 2015, and they were doing a documentary on sex trafficking, but I was the only male survivor come advocate that was prepared to talk. And so it went from being a small part of it to being the basis for what they ended up building this documentary around. And it's gone very well. There's like 8 or 9 awards. They're talking Oscars, range of things.
Nice.
And I keep on getting asked about, okay, well, that's by people one slice of the life, but they want to know the rest of the story. So I'm starting to try and get that down because I really want to help people. It's very important to me that what I went through is used for good.
Mm-hmm.
It's very important to me that it adds up and means something in the greater scheme of things. And I talk in there about the elephant on the chain and how, you know, these elephants in Asia are tied to these tiny stakes and tiny chains. And they do it because they're raised from birth like that. And often we allow ourselves in the same mindset, is that we allow these things that happen to us to define and restrict our growth in our life. And I think it's very important that, like the elephant, we understand what we were created for, what we were designed for, and we have incredible latent potential, and we have to break free of these stakes and these chains.
Yeah, we develop this learned helplessness.
Yeah,
and we think we can't do anything. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's a very good way of putting it.
Yeah, you know, tell us a little more about, you know, what it is that you do and what you have going on.
Well, the focus has really been the documentary for the last 8 months or so. We've got a big release coming up. We've got a Hollywood premiere on September 26th, nationwide release September 29th, which happens to be my birthday, which is an awesome gift to me for it. And then I work in the area of advocacy around the whole issue of sexual abuse and human trafficking. So what I'm doing is trying to leverage the notoriety that's coming with this documentary to bring the conversation to the fore. There's lots of people who want to be associated because it is doing so well. So I'm taking that and very calculatedly using it to bring the conversation into the mainstream. I'm continually surprised at the number of people who don't believe that, you know, sex trafficking is an Asian thing. Whereas Americans, we are incredible consumers of flesh, you know, here and overseas. You know, the Western world, it's Australians the same. It's horrendous what happens through Asia because of Australians. So that's what I'm working on. We do a lot of awareness seminars, how to keep your kids safe, how to be aware of human trafficking in organisations, how to identify traffickers, how to identify, you know, traffickees, you know, trying to break some stereotypes, understand that 45% of all traffickers are female and that over 50% of all people trafficked are male. So if you're looking for the black middle-aged man trafficking the white 16-year-old girl, then you're going to miss the 24-year-old Asian lady trafficking the black 13-year-old boy. So we really need to, you know, break a lot of those stereotypes if we're going to do a lot of good and see this horrendous issue addressed in our lifetime.
Yes, crazy statistics. But, yeah, I know that you have a lot going on today and you're doing some great work. So I think it's really great. And I know that, you know, it's going to make a difference for people. And hopefully, you know, this podcast episode is making a difference for people as well. And I really appreciate you taking the time to come on here. And I have one, you know, final question today before we kind of wrap things up and I let you go. And that is, given what you know now, if you could go back to when you were going through your tough times and give yourself one piece of advice, what would it be?
It'll be okay. It all works out. It all works out. It all works out in the end. It's not over till the fat lady sings. It all works out. Just trust. Just relax. It's going to be okay. I spent too many years striving, regretting, fearful. You know, what do you do, man? I'm 50 and I lost everything. You know, would I ever be loved again? Would I ever find someone again? Would my kids ever talk to me again? Two do, one doesn't. You know, would I ever own a house again? Car again, you know, would ever be able to go shopping again without crying and bursting into tears, you know, and it's working out. So anyone who's going through it, it's going to be okay. Just don't stop. You know, there's a great passage in the Psalms that says, "Though I walk through the valley of shadow of death, I'll fear no evil." The idea is to walk through the valley of shadow of death, not buy timeshares in the bloody thing. And I think we just need to get up and get going, you know, because it's going to be okay. It's all going to be okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know it's hard to see that when you're going through it and things are really bad, but that's typically what happens. Yeah, things will be okay. And you just have to just go easy on yourself in the process, you know, and keep moving forward, like you say. And don't give up.
And, you know, eat ice cream. Just know full well it'll make you crazy for a little bit, but go eat some ice cream. Be okay.
Have some fun.
Yeah, you have to.
You do. You do. I mean, one, that's a lesson I've learned firsthand, you know, that we can just make things more difficult for ourselves than they need to be. We need to just, if we can just relax a little bit, you know, and trust that things are going to be okay, then it makes things a lot easier.
Yeah, it does.
So before I let you go, how can people find out about everything you have going on and, you know, how can they connect with you and all that stuff?
Well, we're just consolidating our websites at the moment. We've got a lot because they all grew up around different. The poetry site is noworkingtitle.org. If they'd like to have a look at the poetry or that book's been an incredible help for people, particularly for guys who have been abused or veterans with post-traumatic stress or their wives. The GiveThemAvoice.foundation site is where we talk about our human trafficking. And Dr. John A. King is where we talk about the stress to strength. So all of those will be coming together, and we're on all the major social media platforms. And, you know, if I can help people, I'd like to. I do a lot of writing and posting because, you know, like you do, Melissa, I wanna help people get out there and get whole. So thank you for today very much.
Yeah, absolutely, and thank you as well. It's been great to have you on, and you know, I think we talked about some good stuff, and hopefully this has been helpful for those listening, for those who are, you know, still struggling. I think that this is very hopeful, you know, and your story is very hopeful. So yeah, just thank you for coming on, for your time, and for sharing everything. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, love. You're well.
All right. Well, I hope you have a great rest of your day.
Yes, ma'am. I plan to.
Thanks for listening to the show today. This has been the Grass Gets Greener podcast, episode 110. Go to thegrassgetsgreener.com/John King to find the links mentioned during this episode or to leave a comment. So I hope you found this episode helpful. And what I really like about what we talked about here today is how we can turn our post-traumatic stress into post-traumatic strength. We have that power within us to heal and make ourselves whole again. And don't be discouraged if you're having a bad day or a bad part of your day like we were talking about. It doesn't have to mean that, you know, the rest of your day or the rest of your week or whatever the case may be is going to be that way too. Don't give the bad moments more power than they deserve. Focus on the positive. Focus on the things that go right and what you can do to help make more things go right. I mean, that's something that I practice myself, and it definitely helps. And come back in 2 weeks for the next episode. I'm going to be joined by Michelle Lewis of VisibilityVixen.com, and we're going to talk more about how we have the power within us to create the life that we want for ourselves. So be sure to come back and check that out if you're looking for some more inspiration. And also, don't forget to head over to the show notes page to grab your free download of the top 10 most common strategies and tools that my guests have used for overcoming the effects of their past traumas. And again, that's over at thegrassgetsgreener.com/John King. And also, if you have a minute, don't forget to head over to iTunes or Stitcher to leave the show a rating and review so that we can reach as many survivors as possible. And as always, have hope.